To the court. We have two cases this morning. The first one is United States versus Washington. Mr. Feldmeyer, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
I am.
And Major Berrios, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm honored to be here speaking before you this morning because something was denied to my client, Lieutenant Jamal Washington, when he attempted to testify about the offense with which he was charged.
Counsel, I need to slow down a little bit because we're getting reverb. Just slow down.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thanks.
The military judge improperly ruled that the res justi of his offense was covered by Military Rule of Evidence 412. The military judge compounded his error by holding that the only way that my client could comply with Military Rule of Evidence 412 was to submit to cross-examination in a closed hearing in which he hadn't testified on direct. The military judge further erred when he held that any physical act that might, quote, implicate the alleged victim's sexual orientation was sexual predisposition evidence and could not be admitted by my client. However, the military judge refused to apply that ruling to the government's evidence, often covering the same physical act. The error was not harmless, both because it infringed upon my client's constitutional right to testify in his own defense, and because trial counsel leveraged this ruling to call my client a liar. Members of the court, every other court that has considered this matter has held that res justi evidence is not included within Military Rule of Evidence or Federal Rule of Evidence 412. United States Army Court of Criminal Appeals in Gaddy, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals in Key, federal civilian courts applying.
Now, when you say federal civilian courts, are you referring to circuit courts or are you referring to a couple of district courts?
I'm referring to a couple of district courts.
So 412 has been around for a long time, both in the military and in the civilian world. If that were to be the case, that all res justi evidence is not covered by 412, wouldn't we expect to see this in the case law?
I think because it's so plain that res justi is not covered, no other military or civilian justice has really ever tried to do this.
So I'd like to better understand the analytical underpinnings of your argument.
Yes, sir.
Are you saying that when we look at 412 as a court, when it lists three explicit exceptions, that we actually should be grafting on a fourth exception, or are you taking some other approach?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that the term other sexual behavior doesn't include the circumstances surrounding the charged offense.
Okay, but you're saying res justi evidence, generally, as I understand your briefs and your argument here, that there seems to be, from your argument, no limiting principle, that if it is res justi evidence, it is not covered by 412. Are you saying instead right now that this evidence does not fit within the explicit language of 412?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that
the latter.
The way that 412 derives other sexual behavior is informed by the way that the Rules Committee defined the same in the federal rule, simply because the military rule is based on the federal rule. And the Rules Committee held that inextricably linked conduct is not within the scope of the 412 exclusion, the general 412 exclusion on other sexual behavior, because it's not other sexual behavior. It's the sexual behavior at issue in the charge.
So if this court were to look at the statements that were allegedly made by the victim in this case, CP, and say 412 was implicated, where does that leave us in terms of your argument about res justi evidence?
If you were to hold that 412 was implicated by the statements themselves, well, number one, it's not sexual predisposition evidence, because as the rule defines sexual predisposition evidence, that doesn't apply to sexual thoughts. It's whether or not it's other sexual behavior. Now, if you were to hold that the statements about the statements during the course of the charged conduct were not res gestae, even though they occurred simultaneously almost with the charged misconduct, we'd still be at the point where in 412 the military judge didn't allow my client to do what this court said in both St. Jean and Sanchez he could do, i.e. proffer the evidence. He said the only way that you can comply is by submitting to cross-examination in a 412 hearing.
Counsel, on that...
Judge Banks.
Counsel, on that point, I mean, I think the government's position was, but we can't make a proffer because until we can't make a proffer about what we're going to ask him on cross-examination because we don't know what he's going to say. We haven't had an opportunity to interview him. And so how is this supposed to work? Suppose the court allowed your client to testify, the government would then cross-examine, but each time the government would ask a question, there'd be a 412 objection, and then we'd have to go back and deal with it. I mean, I think the government's position, if I understand it right, was we need to be able to make a proffer so that we can ask questions on cross-examination.
Well, I mean, a couple things about that. Number one, they just needed to proffer the subjects on which they wish to inquire. If the subjects were relevant within the scope of 412, they were admissible. Second, my client has no duty to help the government admit its own evidence. That's...
Well, I understand that. I understand that. But the procedure you're contemplating would be your client testifies, the government then asks a question without knowing whether it's a 412 violation?
Well, I mean, I think that this court could cut through the conundrum by simply holding that res gestae evidence is, at least in this case,
admissible.
Well, I know,
but this is your second argument. I mean, the first one is that it's res gestae, and if we go with you on that, then we're fine. But on the second one, I mean, I think the military judge had a difficult position there.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, this is not an unprecedented circumstance where somebody where an accused testifies about the misconduct with which he's been charged and has not, prior to the date of court, submitted to OSI or CID investigation. That's not unprecedented at all. I mean, trial counsel was in no different position than if, say that my client had done what the military judge said he should have and proffered his testimony in 412 hearing before he got on the stand about the res gestae. The trial counsel would have been in the exact same position as he was in this case, and that's not an unusual situation. And that's why the government can meet its if there is a 412 requirement here, which we, of course, submit there isn't, the government can meet its obligation simply by proffering the subjects in which it wishes to inquire. And those subjects are limited by the direct examination, so their relevance has already been established, as it was in this case. I mean, doubly in this case, the relevance...
Okay, counsel, because I wanted to ask the follow-on question to Chiefs, and Judge Maggs asked this question, so I don't want to get too far from it. I'll forget it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but to go back, when you are discussing the res gestae, and I thought this was where you were going to go, are you distinguishing between the statements made versus the physical acts that immediately preceded?
Well, I mean, the physical acts that immediately preceded are, I think, the government conceded their res gestae in their brief before the Airport Court of Criminal Appeals because when we argued that the ruling should have applied equally to the government and to the defense, they said, oh, no, it's res gestae. It was proof of non-consent. I think that the statements made during the course of the charged incident are also res gestae, but it's not critical to for this court to decide in our favor whether or not they were, because the fact that the physical acts that tended to indicate consent were excluded is enough for this court to rule in our favor. I was just going to say that the relevance of these physical acts was firmly established because the alleged victim testified about them on direct, and the government elicited them from the alleged victim. So the relevance of these physical acts had already been established in the record. The military judge's decision to strike them was therefore even more inexplicable because the relevance and admissibility of these physical acts had already been established as a result of testimony that the government elicited. That brings me to my third point.
Before we move on, how would you define, one way or other, we're going to have to define res gestae. We're going to have to say exactly what it includes and what it doesn't include. What What do you think the definition should be?
I mean, I think the definition should be the one the Rules Committee adopted, inextricably intertwined with the charged conduct. I mean, more to the point, Your Honor, in this case, you don't have to set the outer limits of what res gestae is because the conduct here so clearly is. It happens simultaneously with or minutes before the charged misconduct.
But one of the problems here is we have statements that were made during the incident of the charged conduct, but the statements relate to other activities that occurred before or things that may have happened before. What do we do with that?
Well, Your Honor, if my client had attempted to call up the – I assume you're referring to the statement, men and women have come on to me.
Yeah.
If my client had attempted to call to the stand those men and women and have them testify about what they said to come on, then that would be 412 because it would be an other sexual behavior because that would be evidence of the actual intrinsic act. But here you're not relying on the statement for the truth of the matter asserted. You're relying on the statement for state of mind at that time. So that would be res gestae. The evidence of the underlying acts would not be.
Was that made clear that they weren't being admitted for the truth of the matter asserted?
That meant I don't think it's really relevant whether men and women had actually come on to him, Your Honor. And I'm sorry, I spoke over you while you're.
Well, I think you answered the question.
Your Honor, the trial counsel leveraged the military judge's exclusion of my client's testimony to call him a liar. He stated in his closing to the panel that because my client denied the alleged the actual physical act with which he was charged, but that there were no details supporting that denial, he was a liar. And that allegation infected all of the remaining specifications.
Counsel, how do you respond to the government's argument that because the appellant denied the contact took place, that none of this consent argument really matters?
Well, my client is allowed to raise inconsistent theories of defense, even contradictory theories of defense, and the government doesn't get to choose for my client which theory he is or isn't allowed to raise. And it was perfectly a reasonable strategy and something that may have resonated with the panel, that here you have two highly intoxicated individuals, both of their memories might be faulty, and it could be that actually when my client says, I didn't actually do this, that maybe there was, but that there was consent. That would be a reasonable thought process for the panel to reach, but they weren't permitted to do so because of the military judge's improper ruling. Again, because I would allege that this is a constitutional matter, that he was denied the ability to testify in his own defense about the circumstances surrounding the charged misconduct, that the standard is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. And because he wasn't able to get that thought process, the one I just referenced before the panel, that there's not harmlessness here. Pending the questions of the members of the
Council, on that point, the government says in its brief that the evidence may well have been admissible, but it had to go through the 412 hearing. And in other words, there was really no ruling on whether it was admissible in general. It's just it wasn't admissible without going through the 412 hearing, and then your client didn't go through the 412 hearing. Now, your argument is that there were improper conditions set on the 412 hearing. But is the government otherwise correct that there was no ruling that the evidence wasn't admissible or couldn't be admissible notwithstanding 412? It's just there was no 412 hearing that went through.
Well, there was a 412. There was a 412 hearing, and the military judge said you have to testify, otherwise I'm going to strike your testimony. I mean, that was inside of a 412. I think that the military judge didn't rule that the testimony was relevant or because it clearly was relevant. He did rule that the same acts that when my client attempted to have his testimony stricken on the same grounds that my client's testimony was stricken, the military judge said that it was relevant and that he wasn't going to strike it on that basis. So there wasn't a ruling that my client's testimony was inadmissible under 412. It's just that A, 412 didn't apply, and B, Sanchez and St. Jean, he didn't have to submit to cross-examination in order to proffer it. And that's what the military judge said you must do.
If we rule in your favor, what do we say to the government? How should the government have made a proffer at that 412 hearing of what it wanted to ask on cross-examination?
We wish to ask your client, for example, about the physical acts that he said did or didn't occur. We wish to ask him about these statements that he – I mean, the government was already limited to the scope of the direct. And the scope of the direct being relevant, there was if the government had simply proffered, we wish to stay within the scope of the direct, there would have been no issue. Members of the court, owing to the numerous levels of error within the military judge's ruling, this court should set aside both remaining specifications, set aside and dismiss both remaining specifications and the sentence. Pending any further questions from the members of the honorable members of the court, I seek to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Fellmeyer. Major Barros.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Vanessa Barros, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. The military judge put appellant on notice that if he wanted to get into 412 matters, he needed to ask for a hearing. But appellant did not do that. Instead, he got on the stand and testified on direct examination about sexual behavior and predisposition. Appellant refused to cooperate in determining whether cross-examination on those same matters would be admissible, which effectively precluded the government from cross-examining him. Considering this, it was reasonable for the military judge to strike part of that testimony to ensure a fair trial.
Counsel, on that second point that you made, that appellant refused to participate in the 412 hearing by going through the cross-examination, Mr. Fellmeyer just said, well, the government could have made a proffer, could have just said, we want to ask about everything that he talked about on direct. Why was anything more needed? Why wouldn't that have been a sufficient proffer?
Because appellant was the source of that information, and trial counsel did not know what appellant's answers would be. And so when trial counsel told the military judge that his cross-examination would delve into 412 matters, it was not arbitrary for the military judge to want to hold a hearing to determine whether the answers, appellant's answers would then cross into 412 matters. And so for that reason, Your Honor, the government couldn't simply proffer. In fact, the trial counsel did tell the military judge the subjects in which he wanted to talk about, but that wasn't enough. The military judge wanted to hear more from appellant, and that wasn't unreasonable in this circumstance. But, Your Honors, I would like to discuss that portions of appellant's testimony was governed by 412. And this court doesn't need to resolve the res gestae issue because we have the plain language of the rule. And the rule defines other sexual behavior of things that include any sexual behavior not encompassed by the alleged offense.
So your interpretation of that statement, and that is what the rule says, seems inconsistent with virtually every sexual assault case we get up here. When we get testimony about they were at the bar, they were flirting, this happened, this didn't happen, the facts are contested, nobody ever raises their hand and says, but these are all 412 evidence. We can't talk about these things. There's never a 412 hearing. How is this at all the interpretation of the rule that you're suggesting here, how is it consistent with how court-martials are done every day?
It is consistent because the military judge has broad discretion in determining the scope of admissibility and is also determining the mode in which evidence is presented. If you look at MRE,
so all those other cases, the military judges were just wrong, or they were at one end of their discretion. They could have ruled all of that evidence, what happened at the bar, what happened in the car, who said what to whom. That would all be 412 evidence normally, or could be, within the military judge's discretion?
Yeah. Your Honor, I'm not saying that the military judges in those cases were wrong. It's within their discretion to determine what's encompassed as part of the charged offense. And here, the military judge made findings of fact and said that the thigh touch and the hug was not encompassed by the charged
offense. So you want this court to hold that every single thing that happens up to the moment of the charged offense, the penetration or whatever it is, everything that happens up to that is potential 412 evidence. Is you want to have 412 hearings in every court-martial with every sexual assault for every bit of evidence for the entire occurrence, whether it's an evening or whatever it is, up to the moment that the government intends to charge?
Perhaps, but it's going to be on a case-by-case basis of what is encompassed within the charged offense. And the charged offense here was appellant touching genitals. And the military judge made
right, and normally, that's very typical, right? Normally, it's penetration of something, right? And so there might be touching, there might be talking. There's all kinds of things that might happen up to that moment. That's all potential 412.
But I think in this case, this court should look to the facts of this case and look at the military judge and what he found here. And he found that the consensual hug and thigh touch, and I quote, different sexual contacts, they are separate and distinct factual assertions than the charged conduct. And therefore, other sexual
behaviors. But that seems like it would be true in every case. Right? Like a defendant might get on the stand and say, oh, I touched her knee. She didn't flinch, she didn't recoil, she didn't tell me to stop. I thought I was getting green lights, right? This is the kind of testimony we get, especially in mistake of fact cases. So that's all 412 evidence. Going forward, after we write our opinion in this case and you win, that's all potential 412 evidence.
It could be, yes, Your Honor, if you look at the plain language of the rule and the military judge has discretion to determine what's encompassed.
But you're also going to say that if he wants to get on the stand and make that testimony, he's got to proffer it, right? Because you're going to say, well, you didn't proffer that evidence. You didn't tell us you were going to get up and say you touched her on the knee. Right? So then we're going to have a slew of errors because there's not going to be any proffers because nobody thinks this is 412 evidence.
Possibly, Your Honor. But yeah, but you could have proffers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be admissible. I mean, the conundrum here in this
case
is that.
So that's what you want. You want proffers from defendants about everything they're going to claim happened, and then we're going to have 412 hearings to decide whether or not any of the exceptions, well, first, whether or not it's proper 412 evidence, but then whether or not any exceptions apply. That's the regime that the government envisions how all these cases should go. Because that's how they wanted it to go in this case.
But each case is going to be fact-specific, and some cases, yes, there will be proffers. Most often there are proffers. But here,
but isn't the government always going to complain that you didn't proffer? We won Washington, right? There's a rule. This is all 412 evidence. You didn't proffer this before you got on the stand.
It could be, but I think if you look at this case and the findings of fact that the military judge did not abuse his discretion, and I don't think this court needs to get into the res gestae issue per se. Because
but how are we going to have a clear rule going forward unless we do answer the res gestae, especially since some of the CCAs have already weighed into it, right? Isn't that the whole point? We're supposed to create a uniform military justice system. Is the rule going to be different in some of the branches? Isn't that what we're here to figure out?
No, Your Honor, I think the message to the field is that the military judge should be afforded the deference to determine what's encompassed by the charge sheet because the military judge is going to have the benefit to know the charging scheme, the victims in this case. He's going to have the benefit of looking at motions practice to know the theories of cases for both sides. And so he'll be in a better position to determine what's encompassed by the charged offense. And then
still, but that's what the government wants, a case-by-case approach where every single statement and act leading up to the charged act, leading up to but not including the charged act, is potential 412.
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at this
so case, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead. You can finish the answer.
No, Your Honor.
you can finish answering Judge Hardy, then I'll ask my question.
I think I lost my thought at this
okay.
point.
All right. I'm sorry. Sorry, Judge Hardy. But it's the follow-on to that, because I'm sitting here, listening to the dialogue, and I'm trying to distinguish then and understand government's position. It based upon what you are arguing, then how do you characterize the victim's testimony? Because the victim was testifying about that same time period leading up to the alleged conduct. And the victim made comments that could very easily coincide with what the appellant had said in the sense of how this was playing out. So how would we, based upon Judge Hardy's argument, how would we distinguish then those statements that the victim makes and from it being 412? Why aren't those statements also encompassed under 412?
I have two responses to your question, Your Honor. First, if you look at appellant's appendix, and when he's claiming that he's talking about a leg touch, if you look closely at the record, in fact, he never testifies to a leg touch. He's actually talking about the charged offense. And so that's point one. But point two, Your Honor, are you assuming you're referring to the non-consensual kiss that led up Firm's testimony?
And the testimony that says, "Hey, I'm sorry, I'm not into that. I'm not into any of that," or some. I don't have the JA in front of me, but whatever that statement is.
Well, regarding to "I'm not into that" or anything like that, the military judge put appellant on notice back at the initial motions hearing, and that if the defense believed that the door was open, that testimony would open the door, then they needed to ask for a MRE 412 hearing. That did not happen in this case, and in fact, trial defense counsel did not object to any portions of CP's testimony. But going to the non-consensual kiss, this court has noted that it is an open question why a prior accusations of non-consensual sexual acts are covered by MRE 412. And this is noted in United States v. Erickson, not cited in our briefs, but happy to provide this court a supplemental citation. And here, the court commented that we question whether MRE 412 actually applies in this case. We fail to see how the sexual assault of a victim relates to victim's sexual behavior or sexual predisposition. So when testifying to this non-consensual kiss, it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the military judge not to flag that as a potential 412 issue. And so that's how you can distinguish what testified to versus what appellant testified to. And there's no question that when appellant testified that men and women came on to him, that was sexual predisposition. And as Your Honor, Mags mentioned, that could also refer back to other sexual behaviors and other past sexual history. So appellant's testimony implicated MRE 412. And with that, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in wanting to hear more in a close 412 hearing. And the issue is that appellant was the source of the information in trial counsel, although he told the military judge the subjects in which he wanted to delve into, we just don't know. We didn't know what appellant's answers would be. And had the military judge, as appellant would have preferred for trial counsel, to simply just cross him on 412 matters before the members, at that point, the military judge would be gambling. Because, as we all know, the reason why that we have closed 412 hearings is because evidence that are associated with a victim's prior sexual behavior tends to be highly prejudicial, embarrassing to the victim, and can confuse issues for the members. So not only did the military judge have to make a 412 determination, but he also had to make a 403 analysis determination baked into the rule in regular 403.
So, Major Barros, I'd like to build upon the questions posed by Judge Hardy. So let's separate this into two parts. And I'd only like to focus on the aspect of what the accused testified physically occurred within that hotel room, not the issue of the statements that he allegedly made. Now, he was testifying that what happened is there was a lasting or lingering hug, that they both were lying next to each other on the hotel bed, so touching of the thigh. Now, your point in your brief is that if this court were to get to the issue of prejudice, that this didn't matter because appellant was able to testify that the touching of the penis never occurred. But the accused had the right to address both things, to argue in the alternative, in terms of saying, "Never touched his penis, but members of the panel, even if you think I did touch his penis, it was either consensual or there was a reasonable mistake of fact as to consent. Why didn't the military judge, by his ruling, completely pull the rug out from underneath that aspect of the argument?
Because appellant was still able to assert a defense, which is why.
So the government or the military judge gets to decide what defense an accused is going to be able to present? It's the military judge says, no, I've decided that you've done enough by arguing that or by claiming through your testimony that the touching of the penis didn't occur. I am going to preclude you from talking about how there was consent or the reasonable mistake of fact as to consent.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I don't think this is necessarily a case where the military judge precluded appellant from asserting additional theories of defenses. The military judge gave appellant
three choices. That's how you argued it in your brief, is that there can be no prejudice from this. That's the approach you took in your brief.
That's true, and we still stand by what we stated in our brief, and for reasons as discussed in our brief, because appellant was still able to assert a defense. But
do you concede, I don't mean to interrupt, but does the government concede that the military judge extinguished the consent defense or the mistake of fact defense?
No, Your Honor, because if that...
So what does it mean when the panel comes out and they say, they ask for clarification and say, so we're supposed to disregard that it was consensual or just disregard the portion of sexual orientation, and the military judge says both, right? Both. So disregard that it was consensual. How did that not extinguish an entire line of defense?
Because if that defense was so important to appellant, he could have simply participated in an MRE 412 closed hearing, and the military judge didn't state that this was going to be
inadmissible. Well, tell me, I want you to explain, how is that statement, the both, that question and that answer, how does that not extinguish that line of defense? You just said it's the government's position that it didn't. So I want you to explain to me how that question and that answer did not, no matter what happened beforehand or what he did or didn't choose to do in 412, how did that question and answer not extinguish that line of defense?
It didn't, because defense had an incoherent theory of the case, and if they were going to argue
you
that
can say they had an inconsistent theory of the case, but they're allowed to do that, right? Was there any way the panel, after that question and answer, could have found that the charged conduct was consensual?
No, because first, the military judge properly struck that testimony for reasons discussed, but even then, the defense didn't have a coherent theory of the case, because if they are arguing consent, then at that point, you are not contesting that the charged offense happened. And if you take that at face value, that actually undermines appellant's testimony in which he's denying.
And that is a risk they are absolutely free to take, right? They are free to get up and say, my client never did it. But if you think he did it, then he thought it was consensual, or at least he had a good faith, mistaken belief of fact that it was consensual.
Your Honor, that is a risk that the defense could take, but for the reasons that I discussed, that if you're going to argue consent and that's going to undermine appellant's testimony in denying the charge, it's still harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because at the end of the day, the military judge...
How can we know that the outcome might not have been different if the military judge had answered that question differently?
We know, because I think if you look at the entire record, I mean, he testified credibly.
Right. And they acquitted on two charges and they convicted on two charges. Right. So it's not like the government had a slam dunk case. How can we be so certain that if the military judge hadn't answered that question differently, that the outcome might not have been different?
Because the military judge instructed the members that they were not supposed to take any negative inference from the fact that he struck appellant's testimony. And members are presumed to follow the military judge's instructions, absent evidence to the contrary. And we don't have that here. And appellant even argues that trial defense counsel leveraged appellant's stricken testimony, but that's simply not the case. If you really take a look at that particular argument by trial counsel, he stated, I want to be very clear on this. The military judge instructed you about portions of his testimony that you must disregard. But you also must consider that he denies what happened with, I mean, that was the crux of this case. And just, you know, to note for the military, and just to note for this court that if consent was such an issue in this case, then trial defense counsel would have asked for a reasonable mistake of fact as to consent instruction, and that was not done in this case. So the crux of their case was the fact that appellant denied the allegation. And for these reasons, that's why error, if any error, by the military judge was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I see my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
I'm going to just ask if my colleagues have any further questions. Please conclude.
The military judge did everything he could to ensure a fair trial. He narrowly struck appellant's testimony to matters not subject to cross-examination, and that was not an abuse of discretion. This court should affirm the lower court's opinion.
Thank you, Major Barros. Mr. Fellmeyer.
Your Honor, I'd just like to correct something that my colleague for the government indicated in her presentation. My client's attorneys did not agree that res gestae evidence should be covered within a 412 hearing. In the 412 notice that the defense provided, Joint Appendix 266, the defense said that they do not concede that res gestae evidence is 412 protected, but they were raising it out of an abundance of caution in the notice. At the Joint Appendix at 270, defense counsel said that he was not going to proceed with respect to his prior homosexual acts. Defense counsel then agreed that if they wanted to get into those prior homosexual acts, that would be raised in a 412 hearing if defense counsel thought that it was opened by the evidence. So it's not correct that defense counsel agreed that res gestae should be considered within the scope of a 412 hearing. The other point that I would like to raise is that the government's construction of military evidence 412 conflates charged misconduct with encompassed by. The rule doesn't say that the sexual behavior is charged. The rule says that if the sexual behavior is encompassed by the alleged offense, it's not other sexual behavior. So the government's construction of charged equals encompassed by is simply not consistent with standard English. Pending the questions of the members of the court, I am probably for my first time ever before here finishing ahead of time.
Counsel, I have one question.
Yes,
so
sir.
If we go down the res gestae path, what is the limiting – that will invite the question, what is the limiting principle then of what counts as res gestae and what doesn't for the purposes of 412? And is the answer to that just, well, there's a body of case law around what counts as res gestae and what doesn't, and that's the answer? Or do you have a different answer?
There is, and it's worked, as Your Honor indicated in your colloquy with my colleague, it's worked relatively well. That we don't require the circumstances immediately surrounding the offense be run through 412, and that allows the government to present its case and the defense to present its case without unfairly infringing upon the privacy interests of the alleged victim. I mean, that's another point here. The whole point of 412 is to protect the privacy interests of the victim. Here, the alleged victim's special victims counsel indicated that at Joint Appendix at 288, he was waiving to the extent that he could military rule of evidence 412. So the ruling here is even more disproportionate than it needed to be in an ordinary case. But to answer Your Honor's question, there's already an established body of case law defining res gestae. It dates from common law.
Counsel, could you clarify the relationship between what is excluded because it's res gestae and what is excluded by the exception in B2? Evidence of specific instances of the victim's sexual behavior with respect to the person accused of the sexual misconduct, if offered by the accused to prove consent or offered by the prosecution.
Well, because sexual behavior is defined as other sexual behavior, i.e., not the charged incident, that covers presumably past sexual behavior of the accused with the alleged victim. It doesn't cover the res gestae, which simply is not within the scope of the rule. Pending any further questions from members of the court, my client thanks this honorable court for its attention to its case, to his case.
Thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:20.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:20.